just a blessing to be with you, and it's kind of halfway between a seminar and a sermon, but I think you'll see what we're doing here. So my wife and I travel as the Masco Science Ambassadors. We're an outreach ministry of Cornerstone Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina, and we've been all over the country. This is our seventh year to travel. We've been out to the West Coast and down to Florida and Rio Grande Valley, and we just came back from New England, and so we just really enjoy getting to know God's people and trying to be a help to them in this area of Bible and science. And so we're looking forward to, the thing I enjoy most is trying to answer people's questions, try to make the science and the Bible understandable to the folks in the pew. So our talk tonight is on the universe's precision design. Every design requires a designer. If you found a watch laying by the roadside, you could safely conclude that it was a man-made, man-designed object. We take it for granted the ability to tell designed objects from ones that lack intelligent design. So you see on the right-hand side, you see what kind of looks like a rock, but it's actually an Aboriginal stone axe. We used to take mission teams to Australia from Bob Jones University. We did that for 23 summers, and I terribly offended an Aboriginal brother when I said it looked like a rock to me. I was supposed to see that this was a finely crafted object, okay? But you could forgive me for thinking it was a rock, right? But if you saw the watch, you would say, you know, that definitely is a man-made, man-designed object. So the idea tonight is that the universe, and specifically the solar system, looks more like the watch than it does the Aboriginal stone axe, that was designed by intelligence and did not arise by chance. So Isaiah 45, verse 18 says, "For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it, he created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." So there's a purpose here, and the purpose for the earth is for life. God created this world for life. Now tomorrow, when we talk to the homeschoolers, one of the topics we have is water, the miracle chemical. We'll do a little bit of that tonight, trying to impress upon them that the molecule of water was designed by God for life, okay? It'd be, you know, funny to read a book saying how the water molecule evolved. Anybody read that book? I haven't read that book yet, okay? That's silly, isn't it? God designed the water molecule for life, and he designed this planet for life, and we're going to see that in a minute. So in what ways does the Earth resemble a precision machine? So here's a chart, and you can see on the y-axis, it goes from minus 0.4 to plus 0.6. And on the bottom, it goes from 1880 to about 2010 here. And so these are the global temperature anomalies, how the temperatures change over that period of time. Now, you can quibble with this. Somebody just sent me an email just a couple nights ago saying that they thought that these numbers were inflated, that it was actually lower than that. But that's kind of the best we can do. You think about how hard would it be to determine the temperature of the whole Earth, you know, the sea and the land and the air, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. How do you combine all that together? So this is about the best we can do. And this is generally accepted in the scientific community. And what you'll notice here is that there's about a 1 degree Celsius change in the last 100 years. Nobody reacted. Only 1 degree change in the last 100 years. I mean, that's amazing. Think about all the things that have happened in the last 100 years. Think about, you know, industry and transportation and fossil fuels and so forth. We've only had 1 degree change in the last 100 years, and this is not the original design. This was cursed by sin. The world was cursed by sin. I would suggest in this political season that you don't get involved in political debates about this, but point people to the all-wise, all-powerful Creator God who made the system, the Earth, so stable that we've only seen a 1 degree change in the last 100 years. Maybe that would be a more profitable thing to do with our times. So let's think about all the things that have to be balanced for that to be true. How to have this energy balance on the earth. Well, one of the things, of course, the energy comes from the sun, a little bit from the moon. The sun's energy bounces off the moon. But the earth is the only planet circling the sun in which life as we know it could and does exist. The earth had a little different mass. If it traveled a little faster or slower around the sun, all life would cease to exist. Most people seem to be unaware that the earth's orbit around the sun is almost nearly circular. We say it has an eccentricity of 1.7%, which is really low, very circular orbit. Extremely narrow range of possible temperatures and pressures and atmospheric compositions that must exist in order to sustain life on the surface of the Earth. And even the rotation of the Earth, if it rotated a little slower, then we'd all, you know, roast during the daytime and freeze during the nighttime. So all that is controlled by God. And Genesis 1:31 says, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." Now this word "very good" that's translated from the Hebrew, "very good," is supposed to be vivid. It's like, look at it and see that it was very good. So after 6 days of creation, the universe not only existed, but was flawless in beauty and function and purpose and in potential. So how does God keep the earth's energy in balance? So this is going to be on the test afterwards. Okay, got to memorize all these figures. So all the yellow stuff, that's all the inputs that we have there from the sun. And we see that some of it is absorbed by the ground, some is absorbed by the atmosphere, some bounces back into space. You see the red, that's all the stuff that goes back out again. So you have this energy balance of the energy coming in, balance with the energy that goes back out again. If you add some of those numbers up, you get the reflection of the incoming radiations about 30%. Absorption by the atmosphere would be 19%, and absorption by the land and water about 51%. But of all the energy the sun gives off, we only get 0.4, 0.45 billionth of that energy, 0.45 billionth. You say, how come so little? Because the sun is so far away, 93 million miles away, which is a good place for a fusion reactor, as far away from me as possible, okay? So 93 million, so we only get a little bit of that energy, 0.45 billionth of that energy from the sun. And this precise balance is responsible for the critical balance of forces that drive the hydrological cycle, the rivers, the rain, the wind, snow, and so forth. We don't see that kind of balance in other planets. For example, Jupiter. Jupiter gives off almost twice as much energy as it takes in from the sun. Now that's, on the face of it, a problem for those who believe in deep time, who believe that the solar system is, you know, billions of years old. Because how does Jupiter do that? How does it give off twice as much energy as it takes in from the sun? Well, it's still cooling down from the original creation, which is only 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. So we can understand that. But the secular scientists have no answer for where the energy is coming from that's being given off into outer space. But that's true of the other planets like Neptune and Saturn and so forth. They don't have the energy balance that we find on the Earth. And that's the reason for that, of course, is Earth is where we're supposed to live. Okay, we're not supposed to live on any of these other planets. And then we have heat that's radiated back into space by the North and South Pole ice sheets, and so that white surface has to be balanced. It's kind of like the air conditioner on either side of the Earth, the North Pole and the South Pole. Those white surfaces radiate more energy back out into space because of their color. If it weren't for these air conditioners on either side of the Earth would be too warm as a result. So we should be thankful for those. And then you have the heat from the Earth's core. There are radioactive isotopes in the crust of the Earth, and they're constantly decaying and producing heat. So as a rough rule of thumb, we believe about half of the heat in the interior of the Earth comes from radioactive isotopes decaying, and about half comes from the original created heat at the beginning when God created the Earth, and it's been cooling down ever since. That has to be balanced as well. And then we have the heat from cosmic dust hitting the Earth. So we live in a dusty solar system, and 5,200 tons of cosmic dust enter the Earth's atmosphere every year. And when it enters the atmosphere, it burns up in the upper atmosphere and produces heat. That heat from the cosmic dust coming to the Earth has to be balanced as well. And then we have heat from tidal forces. You know that the moon and the sun pull on the tides, and they make the tides go up and down twice a day. Okay, but maybe you don't realize that it's not just the water that's going up and down, but actually the land is going up and down, that the rocks are grinding against each other and producing friction that has to be balanced as well. So I wanted to show, I have some demonstrations we're going to do tomorrow, but I found that adults get grumpy if I don't do some for them. So I wanted to show you some friction just to get that idea in your mind. So this is called the thermite reaction. These are some rusty iron balls, and I'm going to put a piece of aluminum over them and hit them together, see if I can get some energy out of here so you can see them. Here we go. Watch. That was a good one. Let's see if I can get a better one. Oh, I like that one. That was good. Okay. So all I'm doing is using friction to release some of the energy that's stored in this aluminum foil. How's aluminum made? They mine bauxite, they put it into a slurry, they put electrodes in it, and they send electricity through it, and that makes the aluminum, and then they roll it out in the sheet. So I was just releasing some of that energy that was there. You may not think of aluminum foil as having a lot of energy, but it actually does. When I got my PhD at Clemson University, I had a lab partner, and he picked up a vial of aluminum dust that was moist, and it blew up in his hand, and he lost a couple fingers, okay? So it can be quite energetic. But so that's friction, heat from friction that's there. And we have the water that's on the Earth. Oh, by the way, before I go there, thinking about the tides and so forth, you think about the waves hitting the rocks on the sides of the continents and so forth. And the estimate is that each year the energy released from the waves hitting the continental margins amounts to equivalent of 25 billion little boy atomic bombs, like the one dropped on the city of Hiroshima, Japan, during World War II. So terrific amount of energy that's released there. You know, you'd think with the moon pulling on the Earth, producing the tides and releasing all that energy, all those equivalent to atomic bombs and so forth, that the Earth would be slowing down, that the Earth days would be getting longer as the moon pulls on it. But it doesn't. In other words, the day, Earth's day, is increased by only 0.002 seconds per century. 0.002 seconds per century. Does that sound more like the watch than the Aboriginal Stone Axe? Sounds more like the watch, doesn't it? And there's also that Earth-Moon system is stabilized by the outer planets as well. And so we talked about Jupiter. I hope you've thanked the Lord for Jupiter when you have your devotions, because it keeps rocks from outer space from hitting us, okay? But it also, energy from the outer planets actually add energy to the Earth-Moon system and keep the Earth day stable, okay? So they play a role. These outer planets play a role as far as the stability of the solar system is concerned. Anyway, get to the water here. We have heat absorbed and released by the Earth's oceans to cover 71% of the Earth's surface. There's a lot of water out there. I mean, this is the same water that Noah was sailing around on. And to give you an idea how much water there is, if the Earth was smooth like a billiard ball, there's no mountains or valleys, the water would stand above the Earth by 1.62 miles. That's how much water is there. And water has a very high heat capacity. We'll talk to the kids tomorrow about why that is. It has to do with hydrogen bonding. But because it has such a large heat capacity, it can absorb lots of heat, release lots of heat, it keeps the Earth tempered, keeps the Earth from being too hot or being too cold. So I wanted to show you a couple of those demonstrations of the high heat capacity of water. So this is a solution of isopropyl alcohol, and salt water, and I have a rag here. I call this my non-burning rag, kind of like Moses' non-burning bush in the Bible.
That was burning.
It didn't burn, so it's a non-burning bush. All right, so here's my non-burning rag. You can see there's no smoke here. The rag's not burning at all. I could do this right over underneath a smoke detector because the water keeps it cool because there's a high heat capacity.
I can touch it. It's not even that hot. Now,
you'd pick. Well, yeah, I'll get it. You don't have to pickpocket me.
I don't know why men always have buttons on their back.
So you can't get my wallet. That's why.
So this rag is made out of cloth, and the reason I took this is because there's something in here, kids, that's made out of cloth, and it's green. Should we try to set some on fire?
They don't care. It's not their money.
A one? No, where's your face? There is still a $50 bill back
It's
here.
A miracle. We went to Boscoff's, and she still has a 50. All right. Amazing. Okay. So American money is made of cloth, and so if I put it in here, it'll absorb the water, and then I can set it on fire. Watch. Okay? And it's fine. It's cleaner. There's no COVID on here or anything like that. So we call this money laundering.
You know that I wouldn't have given him a 50 if I wasn't for sure that it wasn't going to burn up, right? Okay? However, when we went to Australia, and if you go to another country, you know that they don't use American money, but all those 23 years that we went, we always just used American money. But, you know, scientists are curious people. I'm sure any wives out there that are married to a scientist understand that, right? So one day, about 15 years ago, the day before we came home, he decided to set some Australian money on fire. Now, their money is different. Each bill's a different color and a different size. It's really quite pretty. But it's not made out of cloth. It's made out of plastic. Okay? Sometimes the kids say, do a $100 bill, but there's something down the middle of the $100 bill that scares me, so I won't use a $100 bill, because when you set Australian plastic money on fire, well, he didn't come and ask me. He didn't say anything to me. This was the day before we were coming home.
You would have told me not to.
No, I would have suggested that you use the smallest bill, so if it got ruined, you know, it was just the smallest bill, which was a $5 bill.
But her husband's a nitwit, so I used the largest bill.
He'd used a $50 bill and came to me and showed me what happened. Plastic money melts, okay? And I wasn't very happy about that because, I mean, 15 years ago, $50 was worth a whole lot more than it is now. But then I thought, well, in America, our bills get torn, right, and holes in them, and you just go to the bank and they'll trade you. So I said, on our way back to the missionary's house, stop at the first bank, I'll go in, and I was pretty sure they would trade it for me. But what do you think the first question was they asked? How did it happen? No, that's an American question. The Australian question was, do you have a bank account here? And of course I didn't. I walked back out 15 minutes later, trying hard to get a new one, and I had my melted one. But I told the missionaries that we were staying with my sad story, and they said, well, we have a bank account. Maybe we can get it traded. Well, sure enough, we left for America early in the morning. 3 weeks later, we found out that they did indeed get a brand new $50 bill. Now, I like that story for two reasons. First of all,
makes your husband look like a nitwit.
No. You're just curious, that's all. No, I like it because the Lord knew the missionaries needed some money, and we didn't know that. And that was the Lord's way of having us give them some money. And it also leads into, like, 15 years ago, we had no idea that we'd be doing what we're doing these days, traveling around. And it leads into the last demonstration. And we need the pastor to come up right now.
This is your time. You've been praying that your pastor will be on fire. So we're going to answer your prayers here. We're going
to take your coat off and roll up your sleeve. I'll do it first, just so you all know that it is safe, okay? And tomorrow we may do some of the kids' hands tomorrow. But this is what you have to... You come on down here with me.
Absolutely.
So you can watch what I do. I'm going to take my hand, and I'm going to put it all the way to the bottom. I'm going to take my palm and put it all the way flat to the bottom so the water goes about 3 inches above my wrist. Not yet. You wait. I'll go first.
I
want to tell you, you need to push that up a little bit more. We do need to get some of that hair wet, because burnt hair doesn't smell very good. Okay, so down, I don't have, anyway, so down and up. And then I just let it drip just a minute, and then I make a little scoop with my hand, and I scoop off the top over here. I do not go in the water, scoop bubbles off the top. Then I hold it over here, so if it drips, it goes in there. But the important thing is to flatten it and hold perfectly still.
Any volunteers?
I had one pastor made the head of the deacon board come up and do it. Okay, here you go. The waters will protect your hand because it has a high heat capacity.
Okay, now flatten and hold perfectly still. Perfectly still.
Give him a hand. All right. So we'll do that tomorrow with the kids. They usually enjoy that.
I volunteer some children.
Okay. We haven't incinerated any children yet, so we're all right. Okay, so the Bible says that the earth, Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. For he founded upon the seas and established it upon the floods. And so water is like the primordial material that God used in creating the world that we live on. And this brings up the subject of precision in the constants embedded in the laws of physics and chemistry. So these are all constants I used to teach when I was teaching in the classroom: the gravitational constant, speed of light, electric charge, Planck's constant, universal gas constant, Coulomb force constant, permittivity, free space permeability constant, electron charge mass ratio, Stefan Boltzmann constant, Rydberg constant, so forth. Okay, I could have put more there. But what you'll notice about these numbers are all very long. And we know them to quite a few significant figures. And the point is that where did these numbers come from? If these numbers were a little bit different, then life would cease to exist. Okay, these numbers have to be exactly what they are for life to survive on the earth. You say, where did they come from? Well, maybe they evolved. Did you ever think about evolving a constant like that? How does that work? No, it doesn't work that way at all. Now, these numbers are designed by God for life. And then we talked about water being the miracle chemical. This is a phase diagram. Some people get really excited, especially your engineers, when they get excited when they see a phase diagram in church. But what this phase diagram shows is what you see on the right-hand side. That is ice floats. And that's really important. Here where it gets cold, if ice was like any other chemical we know of, then when lakes and rivers would freeze in the winter, they would freeze from the bottom up. It would kill all the fish. You'd have fishicles. But God created it so it forms an insulating layer of ice over the water and keeps the fish alive. Okay? God cares about the fish as well. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow, but that's an important part of this as well. And then you have the greenhouse effect. Now, the greenhouse effect gets, you know, bad press, but without the greenhouse effect, the earth would be too cold. The average temperature would be less than, you know, than freezing. And so what happens is that the greenhouse gases actually trap some of that heat coming from the sun in the atmosphere. Things like carbon dioxide and methane and water vapor. So think about it like this. Think about, you know, on a hot summer day with your windows rolled up, they always tell you to make sure you don't leave your children or pets in the car, that type of thing, because it can get really, really hot. And I was on campus at Bob Jones one time. I had a student from Guam. And I was walking on campus, and here she was in a car, a parked car with the windows rolled up on a hot day. It must have been 140 degrees in there. And I tapped on the window. I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, Dr. Matsko," she says, "I was so homesick for Guam that I found this parked car and I got in and rolled the windows up so it would feel like home." And I thought, I don't want to live in Guam. So anyway, the greenhouse effect, this has to be balanced as well. And then we have heat balanced by air currents. Solomon talks about the air currents. He knew had a modern scientific understanding of how they work. But you know, hot air rises, cold air sinks, and that mixes the heat as well as mixing other chemicals like oxygen and carbon dioxide around the planet. And then you have heat differences because of the tilt of the Earth. Tilt of the Earth averages 23.5 degrees. So this is a picture of the moon going across the Earth that you've probably never seen before. This is taken by a satellite that's a million miles closer to the sun than we are, looking back at the moon going across the Earth. And our moon is really unusual. Most moons go around their planets in the equatorial region, you know, the fattest part. But our moon is in what we call the ecliptic, okay? Remember your 10th grade geometry? Plane is defined by 3 points. So the 3 points are the Earth, Moon, and the Sun. That's the ecliptic. Because the Moon is in the ecliptic and because it's so large, it stabilizes the tilt of the Earth at 23.5 degrees. If the Earth was straight up and down, then all the water vapor on Earth would freeze at the poles, and you'd have a big desert in between. Again, you couldn't live on a planet like that. Now, Mars doesn't have a big moon like we have. It has a couple small moons. And so its tilt varies from 0 to 60 degrees. Okay, you can't live on a planet like that. Elon Musk hasn't figured that out yet, but you can't live on a planet where the tilt varies from 0 to 60 degrees like that. So that's a bit important part of this whole balance as well. And then we have the precision temperature balance of the Earth and the precision that's built into the solar system. Jeremiah 10:12 says, "He hath made the earth by his power, he has established the world by his wisdom, has stretched out the heavens by his discretion." So the precision of the Earth's orbit around the sun can be demonstrated by the fact that the Earth's 365-day, 6-hour, 9-minute, 9.54-second, 66,600-mile-per-hour trip around the sun varies by how much each year? By less than a hundredth of a second. So we're moving around the sun at 66,600 miles per hour. You feel it? Can you feel it? No, you can feel it. Okay. And so we're whizzing through space, and yet the round trip doesn't vary by more than a hundredth of a second each year. And so again, that's like the precision of the watch rather than the stone axe. Now, there's three questions that are raised by this great precision that we see and how God balanced all the energy inputs and outputs. One man said, "How is it that the entire universe is fantastically hospitable to life? The laws of nature themselves seem to be suited to the requirements of life." Nobel Prize winner George Wald said, "How did it happen with what seemed to be so many other options? Our universe came out just as it did." From our own self-centered point of view, that's the best way to make a universe. So you say, what do secular scientists have to say about this? Well, the idea that they have these days is they say we live in a multiverse. And we just happen to live in the one universe where all those constants are just right and everything's just right for life. Okay? Now, this idea came from comic books in the 1920s. Okay. Nothing scientific about it at all. And that's the best they can do, that we live in the one universe where everything is exactly right for life. Also, if the evolution works to evolve life to fit existing environments, why is it not equally conquered all the environments here and elsewhere? Think about the several thousand miles of changing environments from the center of the earth to the center of the edge of the atmosphere. Really only a few feet, okay, near the surface that seem to be ideal for life. Why is it that scientists and evolutionists are so interested in finding life on Mars? They're willing to spend a lot of your tax dollars to find life on Mars because you're trying to disprove this idea that the Earth is the place where God has designed life to be. Or you could say, isn't it naive for me to argue that because the universe is hospitable to life, it was designed to harbor life? Isn't that like arguing like a flea believing that a dog's back was designed to harbor fleas? In fact, it's like that, yes. It's remarkably adapted. A flea is remarkably adapted to living on a dog in an incredibly complex way. Our only habitat on the surface of the earth is that's our only habitat we can live in. If we go into outer space, we've got to take part of the earth with us, the air and the water and the gravitational field. You know, we have to do something to keep the astronauts from dying. If we go down to the bottom of the ocean, the same thing. Okay, so the flea, like many other symbiotic systems, is actually an excellent argument for design. So which came first, the dog or the flea? I'll let you figure that out. So how should we react to God's precision design in the universe that you've heard about tonight? Well, let's look at Psalm 148, and we'll just go through this chapter. You see, praise ye the Lord from the heavens, praise him in the heights. So everything in the atmosphere and above the atmosphere in space was created in such a way as to bring praise to God. Praise ye him, all his angels. Praise ye him, all his host, or his heavenly assembly. So those creatures, the angels, they inhabit a dimension different than ours. There's probably some here with us tonight, but we don't have any perception of them. And they inhabit their dimension as we fit our environment. Praise ye him, sun and moon. Praise ye him, all ye stars of light. So the heavenly bodies moving their mathematically precise orbits demonstrate the Creator's genius. Praise him, ye heaven of heavens, and ye waters that be above the heavens. You remember in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 7, God made the firmament, or the expanse, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. So taking that literally, a lot of creation scientists have theorized that the waters above the firmament are actually on the edges of the universe, that if we went to the edge of the universe, we'd find that we're enveloped in water molecules that are out there. And if you take a literal, some other creation scientists say that water above the firmament is water in outer space. There's some other ideas out there and so forth. But just taking it literally, perhaps the universe is encompassed with an area of water. It's because it says, praise ye the waters that be above the heavens. That sounds like it's on the outside of the universe. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for he commanded, and they were created. He's to be praised because he's able to speak the world into existence. He didn't require billions of years of trial and error to get it right. He did it right the first time. He's also established them forever, and ever hath made a decree which shall not pass. So Genesis 20, verse 11 says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is. The stability of the universe is a thing to be wondered at and admired. And then we see, I guess it got ahead of myself here. Verse 7, praise the Lord from the earth, ye dragons and all deeps. So even the prehistoric creatures and the bacteria found several miles down that live without air are not exempt from this majestic show of life. Fire or lightning and hail, snow and vapor, stormy wind fulfilling his word. So the hydrological cycle certainly shows evidence of good planning. You know, the ancient people never figured out the hydrological cycle. Even though it's all over the Bible, they never figured it out. The Egyptians never could figure out why the Nile River kept going up and down. They thought maybe it was backing up from the Mediterranean Sea. They didn't understand what the Bible had said about the hydrological cycle. Yeah, I'm trying to illustrate thunder snow there, if you've ever been in thunder snow. And then mountains and all hills, fruitful trees and all cedars, botany as well as geology, beasts and all cattle, creeping things and flying fowl. So here's biology again. Kings of the earth and all people, princes and all the judges of the earth. So the earth's most powerful leaders are supposed to be in on this praise thing as well. Both young men and maidens, old men and children. So praise is equal opportunity for all. There's no ageism, no sexism, no racism. And then let them praise the name of the Lord, for his name alone is excellent. His glory is above the earth and heaven. He also exalted the horn of his people, the praise of all his saints, even the children of Israel, people near unto him. Praise ye the Lord. So the horn's a symbol of the Davidic king, Jesus Christ, through whom the Lord grants victory to his people. So what is our conclusion from seeing all this? If you're not praising God for creation, you don't know the God of creation. That's, I think, the simple answer there. Our response should be a response of praise to the Creator. Okay, so what questions do you have about this or any other matters?
You said that the orbit of the Earth around the sun, the time difference is like...
Is that getting faster or slower? It just varies from year to year, okay?
But so it's not necessarily getting slower each
that's right.
time? Okay.
That's right. So it's just varying within that range, okay?
My question involves the length of time that it takes to create these things versus the age of some of these products or fossils or dirt in the earth, where if they were created, say, 10,000 years ago, and they come in and they say, well, this fossil is 100,000 years old. How do we explain the difference?
So they're making assumptions about when they date the Earth. So back in the 19th century, of course, you had Darwin, and he came up with his evolutionary ideas. And it occurred to people that you had to have lots of time for the miracle of evolution to do its miracles, okay? And so back in the 19th century, they thought that the universe was millions of years old. It didn't get to be billions of years old till we got to the 20th century. And so they looked for ways that they could get long ages, okay? And so back in the 19th century, they came up with index fossils that are found in different layers. And so they dated the different layers from these fossils they believe went extinct at certain times. And so they would date the layers of rock from the fossils, and then they would date the fossils by the rocks. So it was kind of a circular reasoning. The only way they got out of that in the 20th century was they had radioactive dating techniques, okay? And they make certain assumptions. They assume that they know how much of the radioactive isotope the parent and daughter were present at the beginning. They're assuming nothing washed in or out, there was no changes. And they're assuming they know something about what radioactive decay rates were in the past. Well, we've only been measuring radioactive decay rates since the Madame Curie, okay, early part of the 20th century. So what do we know about radioactive decay rates 1,000 years ago? And the answer is nothing. We don't have any information about that. Does seem to be good information from some of our measurements that the radioactive decay rates were actually a lot faster in the past. Some creation scientists put that during the flood. Some put it at the time of the fall. But there does seem to be indication that radioactive decay rates have not been constant over time. So they're making certain assumptions to get these dates to be long. And if they're not long enough for them, they just throw them out, okay, because it doesn't correspond to their philosophy of how the world got here. Okay, back in 2005, there was a big Tyrannosaurus rex out in Montana, and they wanted to get it before the poachers got it and sold it on the black market. So they got one of those big Huey helicopters, and they put it on the helicopter with a big femur bone from the dinosaur. It was too big to get into the helicopter. And so they did what a normal person did. They broke it in half. And when they broke it in half, it had the smell of death. Okay, the guy who was doing this, he had worked in the Bosnian killing fields, and he knew what death smelled like. So they took some of the bone with the gooey stuff in it, sent to Mary Schweitzer, who is a chemist at NC State, and she dissolved all the mineral stuff in it, and it turned out to be gooey arteries and veins and blood corpuscles and that type of thing. And so she's an old earther, and so her immediate thought was, isn't this amazing? How is it possible that this 65 million year old dinosaur still has soft tissue in it? Okay, so they're so wedded to their deep time that even when the evidence is right there in front of her, she wasn't able to accept it. We would say as creationists, well, it's obvious this dinosaur is not 65 million years old. It's actually a lot younger. It's actually only thousands of years old, not millions of years old. How do we know that? Well, we know that there's radioactivity coming up from the crust of the Earth that's cooking that soft material. There's cosmic rays coming down from above. And so we know that you can't get more than some thousands of years and have that stuff still being gooey and so forth and look like it was freshly killed. So there's lots of evidence of the young Earth. We talked about it with Jupiter tonight, the fact that Jupiter's still giving off a lot more energy than it takes in. They have no mechanism by which they can have Jupiter give off that much energy over millions of years. It just doesn't work. So when I look at the solar system, it looks young to me. It looks dynamic to me. It doesn't look cold and dead. We went to Pluto. If you remember, we went to Pluto. They were expecting Pluto to be the coldest, deadest planet in the solar system. And when they got there, they found it had the second youngest surface after Io. And there was, it was being freshly covered with methane snow and so forth. And it's young and dynamic, has a little bit of an atmosphere and so forth. And they were just astonished at this. I'm thinking about writing a book called Things That Surprise Scientists. And the reason they're always surprised is because they start with the wrong premise. They're starting with deep time, and they always get the wrong conclusion. So if you start with the wrong premise, you often get the wrong conclusion. And so they're constantly surprised.
Short of the constellations demonstrating the preciseness of God's creation, short of that simple fact of seeing them there and knowing they're there, and they will always be there until rearranged by God himself, is there any other value to looking at them and studying them? Do they have any other relevance to life on Earth other than to simply demonstrate his majesty?
So the just as the outer planets stabilize the inner solar system, stabilize the Earth and the Moon and so forth, our position in the galaxy is also important. If our position of our solar system was in a different part of the galaxy, life couldn't exist because there'd be too much hard radiation. It's like God created like a void around us to protect us, like a bubble that protects us in the galaxy. And even our position of our galaxy, the Milky Way, in conjunction with other galaxies also acts to protect life on the Earth. And so I think, you know, we don't understand all these things, but I think the whole thing is one giant system to protect us here on the Earth. As far as, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, the Bible says. So how do the heavens declare the glory of God? They declare the glory of God through their precision, as we've seen. And they declare the glory of God because they can be seen by everybody. Everybody can see the sun all over the Earth, okay? And so anybody who's seen the sun is supposed to have some knowledge about the power and wisdom of the Creator. They speak to us of these things, okay? And so the heavens do declare the glory of God, and we don't know. Some of these things are so complex and so forth in outer space, it gives us an idea of the greatness of our God. One of the great laws of science is the law of cause and effect. The cause is always greater than the effect. So if the effect is the universe, then our God, the cause, is greater than the entire universe. That's how it speaks to me. This was taken a long time ago by a Voyager spacecraft looking back before it exited the solar system. And so that dot is the Earth, okay, captured in a sunbeam. Okay. And so when evolutionists look at this, they say, oh, look how small and insignificant the Earth is compared to the vastness of outer space. But we know that this is a very small stage on which to portray redemption. Okay, that this is the only place where God sent his son to die on the cross for us. This is a stage for us to show God's love and care for his creation. And so we can interpret this pale blue dot in different ways. Okay, you're amazed. But it's amazing how evolutionists will interpret the pale blue dot compared to the way creationists do. Okay, and so that pale blue dot is this earth that God has created for life. Yes, sir.
Can you just address the issue, because many have probably heard even Christians debating whether or not the flood was global or local. I wonder if you would just address your evidence, et cetera, for that.
Yeah, I have a whole talk on that, of course. It'd take a whole hour. But anyway, there are those who believe in a local flood, and local flood really doesn't make any sense to me, because if you think about flooding the Middle East, okay, you have the mountains of Ararat up here, and you have the Mesopotamian Valley here. You have a flood in the Mesopotamian Valley, all that water ends up in the Indian Ocean. There's nothing holding it there. There's no walls there to hold a local flood. Plus, to have Noah build an ark to hold all the animals, and all the other animals are killed, why didn't they just go over to the next river valley? You know, why build an ark? That doesn't make any sense to me either. So there's an organization called Reasons to Believe, and they're headed by a man named Hugh Ross, who has a PhD in astronomy. And so what he says is that the flood was universal but local. And that's confused a lot of people when he says that. He means that a people only lived in the Mesopotamian Valley, and so it killed all the people in that valley. And so that's why he calls it universal. But he said it's only local because it didn't affect the rest of the world. He talks about how you didn't have to have penguins on the ark, for example, because they lived in Antarctica, that type of thing. But of course, from a flood geology point of view, Antarctica was formed by the flood. Okay, they say, well, there's not enough water to cover the highest mountains, as it says in the Bible. But they're thinking like Mount Everest. But Mount Everest was formed by the flood. Okay, so all the geological features we see on Earth were formed by the flood. Okay, the pre-flood Earth looked a lot different than our Earth does today. So the ICR people have been, Tim Clary especially, he's actually looked at deep well data and so forth. He's actually been able to reconstruct what the Earth looked like before the flood. And it kind of looks like Pangaea. It's kind of like a single continent, okay? And it all broke in part into different continents, that type of thing. So as we look all over the world, we see evidence of the flood. We see thousands and thousands of feet of sedimentary rock all over the world, and we can trace some of those layers. For example, the Coconino sandstone that we see in the Grand Canyon, we can trace it all the way to Pennsylvania. We can find that layer in Pennsylvania. So it must have been a lot of water, okay, to go from the Grand Canyon to Pennsylvania. So anyway, I could go on and on like this, but there's lots and lots of evidence of the flood. Yes, sir, here's your...
So I always follow this guy. His name is like Ken Ham. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I know
Ken. He talked about the geology of the Earth and how it was affected by the flood. I was wondering if a lot of the plate tectonics that we see, like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and a lot of the trenches and a lot of the valleys in the Earth, was affected by like the breach of the water through the flood through the ground. Did the water come up through the ground or something?
So the fountains of the Great Deep were broken open. And so I visualize something like this, like the cracks opened up and that subterranean water gushed up in the sky and then rained back down on the earth. So most of the water, because it mentions the fountains of the Great Deep first, most of the water probably came from underground rather than raining from the sky. Okay. So because it lasted 40 days and 40 nights, hard to get clouds that are going to give you 40 days and 40 nights of rain. And so Ken Ham's right. What do we expect as Christians? We expect to see millions of dead things, you know, buried in layers around the Earth, showing all those creatures were alive during the flood. So the fossil record is a record of what the flood did. So Tim Clary is also, he actually sees 6 or 7 tsunamis that came up over the Earth during the flood, each one getting higher and higher and higher. And not only was the water getting higher, but because of the rapid subduction of the continents, it was actually dragging the land down. So the land's being dragged down under the water while these tsunamis are coming up over the top. And that's why you can go to like the Green River Formation in Wyoming and find saltwater fish swimming around the carcass of a little pony, for example. That's one of my favorite pictures. So how did those saltwater fish get to Wyoming where the pony is and so forth? So we see this evidence so prevalent. We go to the top of Mount Everest and we find clams. We find, isn't that terrible to have to spend all that money to get to the top of Mount Everest and what you look down and what you see is clams. Okay, so at top of every high mountain, we find sea creatures. They were all underwater at one time. Thanks for that question.
This is not exactly related, but do your contacts in the scientific field, are they aware of geoengineering and the cloud seeding? Like, I live in Berks County, and a lot of days I wake up and I see these low contrails, and people are saying that, and I've watched a lot of airplanes fly, and they didn't make that kind of a trail through the sky, except very high altitude, and then it dissipates. But these seem to be deliberate trails of perhaps chemicals. Is there any truth to this from what you've heard? That they're seeding the sky with chemicals to experiment with modifying the weather?
I need more evidence than that. So the Chinese are probably ahead of everybody else as far as trying to control the weather and so forth. And it looks like they've been largely unsuccessful. They've been trying to get the rain in Beijing and that kind of thing. And so I don't think we're at a point scientifically where we can do that. Now, we find during the millennial kingdom of Christ, he'll control the weather. If they don't come up and worship him in Jerusalem, he just turns the water off. So he knows how to do this. We don't. So I don't think we're at the state of science today to be able to control things like that. There's just too many variables involved. Okay.
It does seem like they're trying.
I think they'd love to. I think they'd love. Yeah. One of the problems that they face in this country is the fact if you start controlling the weather, like say if National Weather Service started controlling the weather, then everybody'd sue them. Because if this farmer wouldn't get enough rain, this one would get too much rain, and so they'd spend the rest of their lives in court, okay? And there'd be a sea of lawyers out there trying to make money off of this thing. So you can be pretty sure there's no conspiracies going on in that respect because of the litigious nature of the society we live in.
But they'd be right, at least, when they told us what the weather would be.
Yeah,
all right, if you have another question for him, we're going to wrap things up. It's about 7, getting close to 7:45 now, and I know there are probably more questions that some of you have, but we want to be considerate of the children and those who are watching the children. And so if you have more questions, you can attack him after the service, and he would be glad to answer those to the best of his ability.
Remember, I have these balls here.
And he can light you on fire. And he can light you on fire. Thank you so very much, brother. Can everyone just thank you? Why don't we close in a word of prayer, and then we will be dismissed. Father in heaven, we are again stunned at all that you have done, all that you are currently now doing. We're reminded when we read in Hebrews that you uphold all things by the word of your power. And we got just a small taste of what you are doing at this moment for us, upholding all things so that we might live another day, take another breath. And Father, I pray that you would give us hearts that would praise you and hearts that would be humble before you. Oh, God, thank you for the truths that we have been reminded of tonight. And I pray that you would free us from those burdens that we, those lies that we may hear and be burdened with from our world around us, that we may live in truth and abide in truth. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.